At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to the Vegan Report. My name is Ryan, and today, an exclusive window into a high-stakes world at the heart of the animal rights movement. Hear from the fundraisers driving the dollars that fuel the fight for animals. Those conversations are very common among professional animal advocates, yet always behind closed doors. That is, until now. To discuss this topic, I have with me Alice Mueller Coleman, Development Manager for Balanced, and Liz Wheeler, Philanthropy Managers for Phonolytics. Among other things, we talked about the dangers of toxic work environments. What power do funders hold over animal organizations? And why are sanctuaries the ugly duckling of fundraising? Balanced and Phonolytics are two amazing organizations that deserve your support. Visit the episode notes to connect with them. Lastly, don't forget to show some love for this podcast. Follow the show, share this episode, leave a 5-star review. Every gesture of support counts. Thank you. Liz, Alice, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here. I guess to get us started, an icebreaker question may be one of my favorite questions to ask is, who is your vegan hero and why?
Alice, do you have somebody on the top of your head?
No, and I'm embarrassed to say it.
I'll go.
Amazing.
For some folks who know me, I'm Canadian. I don't say A that much, so hopefully it won't catch me up in the podcast, but it might start coming out a little twangy. My vegan hero is Camille Labchuk. So she's the executive director of an organization called Animal Justice here in Canada, and a huge reason why I went vegan. My journey in veganism, I was vegetarian for like 12 years, and it really wasn't until I started listening to the Animal Justice podcast that she was hosting where I started to learn more about the inherent cruelty of the systems of dairy and eggs. She's definitely one of the driving forces behind the trajectory of my life now.
Wonderful.
That is so beautiful.
Fellow Canadian.
I love that. My husband's actually in Vancouver right now, so he's there championing your team as well. I can't choose one person. I think when you've worked in this field long enough, like, I know thousands of really wonderful humans, you know, some more than others. And I feel like I love so many people in different ways. You know, at top of mind, I'm thinking like Shiftara Punzon from Pura Vida. She's like bringing her culinary experience and making her grandma's dishes yet veganized. And I'm thinking about Matcha, who sells like French pastries at the farmer's markets. And I'm thinking of Jean Bauer, and I'm thinking of our executive director, Audrey Lawson Sanchez. And I can't choose one. I just can't.
It's also a good answer. So both of you are fundraising for different organizations. I would love if you could tell us a bit more about Phonolytics and also Balance.
Yeah, I mean, so Phonolytics, I'm new-ish to the team. I've been with them for about 3.5 years, which I consider new for like the 25-year history that the organization has. We're an organization that conducts and shares research and data for animal advocates. So we have three key programs. One is our original research. So we will conduct studies, meta-analysis, and reports that help fill gaps in animal advocates' knowledge. It can be anything from what is effective tactics and messaging to more niche areas. We did a study with mentioning Jean Bauer Alice. We did a study with Farm Sanctuary in 2021 that looked at a sanctuary tour's effectiveness. We also have a research library. So there are over 6,000 research study summaries, infographics, blog posts, and that's all free access for anybody who wants to go online and is looking for any kind of information. You can sort it by region, you can sort it by keywords, so you can actually sort by species if you want, by tags. So if you're looking for fundraising, there's a bunch of fundraising articles on there too. And then third is our research support program. So that's where we help advocates actually take that research that they've just learned and how to actually put it into practice. So any individual advocates or organizations can come to us and ask questions about how to apply that researcher data and or also like how to conduct a really effective survey. We do that too. So that's about Fawnalytics.
That's amazing.
Wonderful. And I recently covered one of your study with one of your affiliated researcher, Bjorn. Are protest helping animals or hurting them? Something like that. So go check this episode. It's truly interesting. What about you, Alice?
So I'm the development manager over at Balanced, and Balanced was started in 2017 by Audrey Lawson Sanchez, as I mentioned before. She's a mother and former educator, and she recognized that something needed to be done about school food. And so we are a public health and nutrition security advocacy organization that works on institutional diet change, primarily in K through 12 schools. One thing I didn't know is 75% of all K through 12 schools are self-op. So there's a need for a lot of hands-on support. And so we do that in our various programmatic areas. One is community-led advocacy, providing resources and assistance to the community members that want to see change where they eat. Second is institutional support. They're the ones that are really working side by side with the food service teams and doing a lot of exciting things through our plant-based cohort, which is a 6-month program, really getting into the nitty-gritty. And then we have a nutrition research and policy team as well. So our team is working on a data analysis project right now, which is looking to find the fiber content of school meals.
That's also great work. Please connect with Phenolytics and Balanced. Link in the episode notes. Okay, fundraising. I feel like this is one of the topics that goes really under the radar of most people. They don't think about fundraising. They don't think about the fundraisers. We're like this, truly part of the behind the scenes team. So let me start with this. How did you become a fundraiser? How did you fall into this this job? Maybe Liz?
Gosh, yeah. Okay. I'm very, very lucky. I started my career with animals about 15 years ago. I started working, well, I was volunteering actually at my local Humane Society. And through volunteering there, I was able to get a job in their foster department, which is actually like more animal care. It's working with the animals, doing things like sub-Q fluids and vaccines and very hands-on. But to my luck, the Humane Society is actually a unionized environment and it was a contract position. So, in order to stay in with the organization, I had to apply for whatever jobs would come up. And there was one in the development department. So, I got really, really lucky in that way that things just kind of aligned. And so, I took a job in the development department just entering donations because I inevitably wanted to go back to the foster department. But then I ended up falling in love with the fundraising. So, started there and then started working at an organization formerly known as the Canadian Federation of Humane Societies, now known as Humane Canada, and then eventually made my way to Fawnalytics today. But yeah, I've been working in fundraising for like 10 years. It just feels like what I've done my whole life. I know 10 years is like nothing in comparison to a lot of seasoned fundraisers, but yeah, I unfortunately my journey's not very exciting. I kind of had it easy because I just got a job at the Humane Society and then they were like, "Do you want to enter in donations?" And I was like, "Yeah."
But that's an interesting reaction to fundraising, because when I talk about fundraising to people, I see, you know, in their eyes, fear, I see boredom, I see, you know, a mix of emotions that, you know, fall far away from the spectrum of falling in love. So I guess quick follow-up question, what made you fall in love?
I think it's just like the idea that I could do one of the things that I'm most passionate about, which is really like, at the end of the day, I see fundraising as connecting people who love animals with animals. And so that can come in like such a variety of different ways when you're fundraising. And it's definitely not a boring job. I think once people like get into the day-to-day of it, people from my experience are like wary of it because of the whole idea of having to ask for money. But I think a lot of fundraisers who get into it realize it's really not about that. It's about building relationships. And I'm a very social person. I love to connect with people. I'm also very nosy. So I just like to know more about people and like what they have going on and like what their hobbies and interests are. So it's a really good mix for my personality type. Yeah, I hope that answered it.
Those are indeed fitting qualities for the fundraising profession.
Yeah.
Okay, Alice, what about you? What was your journey into fundraising?
Totally. I was thinking about it before the call a little bit. And I just kind of had a flashback of being a kid and doing door-to-door lemonade sales. I wasn't even going to like have a table. I just went door-to-door. And then I started, you know, a little dog walking business when I was 12. And like, I remember I came home from my freshman year of college and my dad said, you need to get a job. So I went on Craigslist and called Greenpeace, got an interview for the next day, and I started canvassing on and off for multiple years. And so, you know, my start was asking people for their credit card information on the sidewalk. And, you know, if you can do that, you can kind of do anything. It's perfect for college kids. I feel like it really gets you out of your comfort zone and you have to navigate a lot of real-time responses. And then the way that I found myself into the animal rights space is I started as Milo Runkle's executive assistant at Mercy for Animals. I remember I participated in putting together the staff retreats, and each department would put on a little skit, and the fundraising team just had the best skit. And it's so silly, but I was just like seeing them up there, and they were all fun and personable. They were relationship builders. They're still some of my good friends today. And I think when you think of it from a relationship perspective, like you were saying, Liz, I mean, you're building relationships and hyping up other people. It's pretty great. You know, it's a harder thing to do to sell yourself. If you're selling people who are doing great things and you believe in what their work is, like, I don't know. I feel very lucky to have landed and feel very lucky to have landed at Balanced in particular.
What a rough start. Like, this is one of the worst jobs out there, having to ask people for money, like in the streets. Did you have any coping mechanism? What was the feeling like at the end of the day? Did you need a drink?
I mean, I was 18, so sheer ignorance, I think. I was just like, oh, this is what it means to work, you know? And the people were fun, too. I mean, you're just like, you care about polar bears, right? And then you talk about chimpanzees, orangutans, or the rainforest and get silly with it. So, yeah, there was a lot of weirdness, and it was a really good experience.
Okay, so fundraising is all about, you know, like Liz said, creating, building those relationships and strengthening them. So how do you convince someone of making a donation? How people come to make a donation to a cause? What's that psychology that, you know, brings us to express generosity?
Alice, do you want to go first?
Sure. I mean, I think it's like, you know, we all have this vision of the type of world we want to live in. And there are going to be things that matter more to me or you, Ryan, or you, Liz, or to the random person down the street. And We all have that vision, right? So whether it is a world where animals are treated with kindness and compassion, or people want to make sure that people don't go hungry, or they want to combat climate change, or any sort of these avenues, like there are things that people believe in, and it's an investment in the future that you want to see, or direct response to things that are happening that have a shorter life cycle in many ways. And so I think it's just the psychology is you're investing in the world that you want to live in.
Yeah, I love that. I would echo everything that Alice just said. I think the approach that I try to take to it is not seeing it as like asking something.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why Mylow's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken in time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Of somebody, but providing them an opportunity to fulfill what they want to do already. So we know people are very, very charitable, that a lot of the times when people make a donation to our organization, they already are involved in the space. They're already animal advocates. Maybe they've used our services in the past, or they know somebody who's benefited from them. And so our job is less about convincing people to donate. Like they've already made up their mind, they're going to donate somewhere. They want to support our movement. They want to see it progress. So it's just trying to communicate with them how we can help them achieve their mission and figure out if we're a good fit for them. It can take years to like get somebody to commit to a gift, but that doesn't mean that they're not interested. It just means that you haven't figured out the psychology around like what is their motivation for giving? Like what legacy do they want to give? Even if it's like a $5 monthly donation, to me, like when I'm donating to organizations, it's because I want to see like progress in my lifetime. I want to see animal cruelty like slow down. I would love to see it end. But that's rose-colored glasses on. But I always just try and treat it like we can help people achieve what they want.
I'm asking this because it feels more and more alien to our societies, to make a donation without expecting anything in return. Everything is so transactional nowadays. You always expect something in return. So, witnessing people just donating for the sake of donating is an intriguing behavior.
So I was really lucky. I got to go to the Association of Fundraising Professionals conference earlier in the year, and it was really eye-opening. I mean, we know that the animal protection space, I'm just going to reference it as animal protection, it's animal welfare rights protection, all under the same umbrella. But like the farmed animal protection movement specifically is so like we are dealing with a very small pot of money compared to like charitable giving. There is billions upon bill hundreds of billions of dollars in charitable giving. Farmed animal protection gets about like 200 to 250 million of that. So we're already dealing with like such a small piece of the pie, but we're also lucky in that sense that people who are in our movement are so dedicated, are so passionate about believing in this cause, that it's really just about figuring out like what their motivation is. And I bring this back to AFP is because I was one of the only people there from like an animal protection organization. I think there were like 10 of us in a sea of 3,000 attendees. But there was one presentation by I can't remember the person's name from Giving Tuesday, and they were talking about donors' motivation. It was like they either donate because of like affinity, so they're connected to the organization. They have a history of philanthropy, so it's like what their family's known to do, what is expected of them. Or they have connections, so they have somebody who's benefited from what you do. That's more like applicable in like hospital settings, for example, or capacity. They've won the lottery, they have sold a business, and they have this ability to give generously, so they do it because they can. So for us, we try and figure out which of those they kind of fall into, because then you can steward them and kind of guide them and talk to them based on what their motivation is. So I found that that's been incredibly helpful. But yeah, for any fundraisers who are listening to this, AFP is incredible. And like, there is just so much information, and there's a lot of data-driven information. Bing, bing, bing. Bing analytics. I'm very data driven, so I like to know, like, okay, where are the numbers? What's showing this?
Yeah, I was really lucky a number of years ago. I think it was my first year working in development. My entire team went to AFP in New Orleans, and that was like such a great team building experience as well as an opportunity just to like hone skills, especially as a newer fundraiser back at that time.
Yeah, I love AFP. I've been a member for years, but I never went to their conferences. Okay, so who is that donor? Can you draw a profile of the typical donor to the animal cause? Are they more, do we have more female donors or male donors? What's the age range? Is there something about their personality that makes them more inclined to give to the animal cause?
I think so. I feel like Liz is going to have the data handled. No pressure, Liz. But from like a more emotional stance on it, like I feel like there is a huge range. You have your effective altruists that want to rely on the data, and they want to see the number of lives that are impacted, and they are more motivated by the hard figures. And then you have the individuals that want to save the life that is in front of them. Those are perhaps people who want to fund sanctuaries, who want to, foster and adopt animals, focus on TNR programs or things that are more maybe companion animal or sanctuary related. And then in terms of like our donors, I feel like a lot of them fall, especially now as we have like grown our institutional support program, where they want to see the number of meals impacted. We talk a lot about fiber. Like our whole thing is focus on fiber. And how do you get more fiber on plates? It's plants. You need plants for fiber. It's the only thing that has it. And 97% of Americans are deficient in it. So our donors are typically those that care about the number of meals impacted, also wanting to see kids having access to healthier options. And that might be different than those that fund other organizations. And that's why I think it's so wonderful that there are so many different organizations that cover the spectrum, and we really need all of them. And what's great is behind the scenes, a lot of us are working together.
That's so interesting. Let me raise this point. Many times, strategically speaking, you can inspire donations by addressing connected issues to your cause. So you mentioned children. That is a way in for donors who might not care about animals, but might, care about children and children nutrition. Do you feel like this is a good way of approaching, donors? Because I've had this conversation with one sanctuary owner and vegan activist who told me, I'm all about veganism, I'm all about the cause, I won't, talk about connected issues, although I could, because I feel this betrays the core values of my organization. What do you make of that?
Oh gosh. Okay. I have so much to say about this question. So, while Alice is talking, I did pull up. So there is a study, well, it's a follow-up study. So we have a reference. I'll give it to you. It's called People Who Support Animal Causes and Who Gives More. So we did look at charity donor behavior. This is from 2019, so take it with a grain of salt. We are now 6 years later. But yeah, as far as demographics go, people giving to animal causes as important, or seeing animal causes as important, are going to skew female, less religious, more liberal. They do tend to have these like everyday animal related behaviors. So normally having a companion animal. And then when you're looking at monetary donations specifically, you're going to be looking at demographics of those who have a higher income, their animal related behaviors. they're probably going to follow a vegan diet, especially when you're looking at farmed animal protection organizations. They may have animal appreciation related hobbies. We do have sections looking at donation methods as well. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but that's just kind of like a sneak peek. So yeah, we definitely have looked at this. As far as like what language to use, I will say don't say vegan. It's the easiest and most accessible way. It doesn't mean that your mission is changing. It's just the language that you're using. If you fill out a grant application and you don't mention vegan, but at the end of the day, your work is pushing forward the shared mission of ending animal suffering, does it really matter if you use that language? No, because you're still achieving your mission. So I would just say, especially when you're looking at collaborating with other either social justice causes, trying to do cross-sector funding with like education or environment. Yeah, just don't say vegan, plant-based. Don't just plant-based, don't say vegan.
You don't even really say plant-based all that much, though our cohort is the plant-based cohort. We talk about fiber-rich, healthy, plant-forward, fiber-forward. We don't use the word vegan. And I don't think it dilutes your work at all, because at the end of the day, if you're alienating people by using specific language, and so they're not willing to meet you at the table or to like take on different behavioral issues or giving, then you're not, you're basically disservicing yourself and in turn the animals. I mean, there's some are going to care about the environment, and if you have the ability and the metrics to frame it that way, you're being completely honest in the way that you're approaching it, and it just so happens to benefit animals.
Liz, the study you referenced, I will add that to the episode links. Please send the study my way. What about trends? Is the world getting more generous or less generous? Is the, donation part shrinking or increasing for the animal cause? Do you see any trends?
I think that once more, Liz is going to have the data. I think that from what I understand, individual giving is down. And like, I mean, we all feel it with inflation and just like how far the dollar or whatever currency you use goes. And that is a real thing. That doesn't mean people aren't giving. I think, like we focus on like the subscription model of like recurring and monthly giving, right? That is like we have become a subscription economy in many ways. So that is like one avenue. I think our revenue is growing, but that is because we have shifted our focus. And we primarily work with our major funders and grants and family foundations.
Yeah. So, yep, I came prepared. I have the data. But before I jump into that, I do want to say, for anybody listening who's a fundraiser with another organization, the struggle is real for all of us. We're all feeling hurt right now. 2025 is a benchmark year, but not in a good way. And it's not abnormal for us to be struggling. So there is community here for other fundraisers. I would be remiss not to give a shout out to the Hive fundraising community calls. They're a really great place to connect with other fundraisers. We have calls every month. Every other month, it's just a community-led discussion where fundraisers get to bring up problems that they're having. The calls aren't recorded, so it's a safe space to kind of bounce ideas off of one another. And then on the other months, we have experts come and talk to us and do Q&As. We had Megan from Green Bomb Foundation, and she did a great presentation on doing pitches to funders. So definitely check that out. But yeah, as far as like the numbers go, yeah, we're seeing a decline in donations. Part of it has to do with inflation. It's really hard to find data specifically to animal protection, and even harder for farmed animal protection. We usually reference the Giving USA annual report. So the most recent data that I have access to is from 2023. I do know that they just released their 2024 report, but we haven't gotten our fingers on that yet. But as far as like 2023, there was a decline in money towards animals in the environment. We're kind of lumped together by 8.9%. So there is a decline. We know that. But of that 3% of the giving pot, only 1% really goes towards animals. So it's hard to know how much of that 8.9% is attributed to environment versus animals. It's nearly impossible to say. Stray Dog Institute did conduct a renewed state of the sector report that was just published, which I'm really excited about. I think it shows that there's between 200 and 250 million in funding. So the 2021 report was 200 million. So it really hasn't increased that much, which is not great. But like compared to the giving sector in total, there was a 3.4% decline compared to 2021. So that's like a loss of like quite a few billions. So yeah, we're all struggling.
Yeah, which, if your fundraising is struggling, then your entire organization and its impact, its reach, will be reduced. That's, the hard reality. And that also highlights the importance of fundraising, of the work we're doing. Okay, so I guess this ties well with my next question, which is, how much power do we have as fundraisers in the organization? And more than that, how much power do funders have over organizations? Alice?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think every organization will have a different answer on this because I know like when it comes to balance, like we do not change our strategy based on a funding opportunity. Like we really have our vision for a reason, and we are very nimble, as a smaller organization, when things do change, like for example, like the administration changed, and we realized that it wasn't going to be impactful to continue doubling down on our USDA component of our Focus on Fiber initiative. So we changed our strategy. That wasn't funder directed, though. And while we will, of course, take feedback, we won't change our strategy based on what they say. As for working within the confines of the organization, I work really closely with our executive director. I mean, once more, we are a smaller organization, so I am the sole development person. And so I talk to her most days, whether it's just a Slack message or otherwise, but we work very closely, and she keeps me very much in the loop because we can't do our jobs without each other, and in turn, the programs teams.
Yeah, that's a sign of good health, organizational health. Liz?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just ditto exactly what Alice said. I think I always see like my role as fundraising, like I'm one person in a 12 person team, and yes, I'm the only one who has philanthropy in their title, but everyone in our organization is a fundraiser of sorts. They're going to hate me for saying this, so I apologize to them in advance. But they're representatives of our organization, and every conversation that they have with an advocate that helps them, that's then can be used for our case for support of, oh yes, we helped this organization. And so it really is like a team effort. And my role is only made easier by the incredible work that the rest of our team does. I can say like without a doubt that we would be completely lost and like without the incredible team that we have. Like all of Fawnalytics' success is because of every single person in our organization. And our leadership is just spectacular. While it's like a one person development team, Brooke, who is our executive director, is there alongside me every step of the way. And we're just very, very lucky to have this like strong team that we have. One thing that I'll also mention is like we We'll create a fundraising plan every single year that changes based on what our previous year's revenue is. So this allows us to look at all of our tactics, like what are we doing with individual donors? What are we doing with grants? Maybe one year it was really, really fruitful for grants, but we always want to be diversifying our revenue stream. So just because one year we had a really great year with grants doesn't mean that we're going to all of a sudden jump ship and ignore our individual donors. So kind of figuring out which areas are most promising, what are maybe new possibilities that we haven't looked into before. I remember the first time that I met Alice, I'm pretty sure I was asking her, like, what do you do with your bequest program? Because we don't really have one. So how can we grow this? So definitely also like leaning into your fellow fundraisers and figuring out what's going well for them and not being afraid to ask stupid questions. That's like the number one thing I've learned is just lean into your ignorance of what you don't know and always be willing to just learn new things because you will. That's, I think, how fundraising plans and how your development and your revenue can grow is by like constantly learning and constantly trying to like figure out that missing piece. And the one way that I describe fundraising to a lot of like my friends and family, I'm like, just imagine me in like a full Velcro suit and I'm just like throwing myself at the wall. And like one arm is like has 12 Velcro strips because I know all of the data. But then this one, I have no idea what I'm doing. So we're just gonna see where I land. And it's a lot of trial and error, because of the lack of data in our area for fundraising.
Yeah, I know that our organization has like a fail fast mentality, and I love it because like it allows us to try things, and if it doesn't work, it's not like an issue. For example, my first year at Balanced, I worked on like a wellness challenge that was like a month long challenge, and I wanted it to be like really inclusive. So it was everything from make a plant-based meal to take a walk to swimming laps, and so that everyone could do something. And it was a lot of work to bring in just a few thousand dollars. And so, like, taking into consideration, like, how much work is it going to be? Could I be doing something else? Because if I can put in a grant application that is worth, like, five or six figures and be successful versus taking a whole month to raise 3, 4, 5 grand, which one am I going to be going to do the next year? Because, it's really working smarter and hard, but not harder, and focusing on like the lower hanging fruit.
Oh my God.
We didn't have a comms person. How are we going to have like a strong individual giving team when we didn't have people who knew who we were? So now we do, and Chris is great, and we're very lucky.
Oh my God. Alice, I love that you mentioned that because in my head, I'm just thinking like we did the exact or I did the exact same thing when I first came into Fawnalytics. I was like, hey, like I was so ready, so amped. And I was like, we're gonna do this donor-centered event. We're gonna call it Data Days of Summer. It's gonna be like a fundraising online event. It's gonna be so great. It's gonna be a benefit. It sucked. Like, no offense to anybody who contributed to it, but it was just like our donors don't want to be thanked that way. And it took me doing it to realize, okay, this is not the right strategy. And so now we have Fauna Connections, which is a research symposium, and that is so much more aligned with Fawnalytics' mission. And we don't need to be like thanking our donors. They come to it and they see the good work that we're doing, and that's how they get their appreciation. So I just absolutely love, Alice, that you shared like failing fast, because yeah, totally did the exact same thing when I started.
And just because you can put on an event doesn't mean you should.
Yes. Yeah.
Well,
Just saying.
this is a great moment to talk about stress, the stress that this job brings. I don't know if you can relate, but I often think of myself as the only one in the organization who's actually bringing money in, and so I have to justify my salary. And I'm always, thinking about, how much of a good fundraiser I am in terms of, how much of a good investment I am for my organization. So what do you make of that pressure to be productive, to bring that money, to keep your organization basically alive.
Yeah, I've been in that position before. Luckily, when I came to Fawnalytics, I felt like I was just like walking into like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. I was like, wait, you have all of these amazing things in place? Like what? I was just like, this is amazing. I think it really starts with leadership, honestly. Like, I hate using this like term like culture of an organization because it's been misused and like put against employees so often. It's like, oh, this is our culture, blah, blah, blah. But truly, like I think if you have good leadership that's willing to kind of like practice what they preach and like take their vacation time off and like set good boundaries and like allow sick days to be used for mental health. Like when I came into Fawnalytics, it was like a no-brainer. It was like your sick days can be used for mental health. If you want to just take like a self-care day with your sick day, like that it is for you to use. And to me, that was like that just took off so much pressure of like worrying, like, oh my gosh, like if I'm sick, if this like grant deadline comes up, it's like very much a collaborative work environment. And I think I would like push back a little and say, like, the onus is really on the organization to set up those things to ensure that employees can thrive. Employees have a responsibility to show up to work every day and to put their best foot forward and to do the best work that they can. But that's only possible when there are structures in place that allow people to thrive and not feel like they are dying every time they come to work and like they're just like a number or a machine, because we're not. And we work in an area where arguably we are facing a lot of really like traumatizing content sometimes. Like I can't tell you how many times like I scroll through like graphic imagery of animals. And it's like just having a good organization and good leadership that's willing to back you up really makes a difference. So I would say, like, from my conversations with other fundraisers, there are great organizations out there. So if you're being treated in a way that makes you feel like a machine, find another job because you will be appreciated. There are people that will appreciate you.
Oh my God, 100%. I am like so passionate about culture, actually, and about organizational health. Because, echoing what you're saying, Liz, like if you do not have really kind, compassionate, and effective leaders at the top who work from like a place of, once more, compassion. Like there doesn't need to be any ego. Like Audrey is the best leader. She is so highly competent. She could do so many of our jobs, and she trusts us so much. She gives us so much autonomy. She's there as like a person to brainstorm solutions when needed. I mean, I live in LA, so we were, fortunately, we weren't as impacted as some, but like we temporarily left our homes during the fires, and during that time, we had a huge grant deadline, and Audrey really stepped in. It's like having a compassionate and effective leader is amazing, and hiring the right people, though, that's like the second step. I mean, not to go off on too much of a tangent, but our hiring process, I've never like been a part of an organization that does it quite this way. And so every time someone new comes on board, there's like this infusion of really good energy. And like I've started putting in our grant applications how, we have 100% retention. People don't leave. And I think that speaks volumes. And yes, if you're not being taken care of and treated as a human first, leave. Find another place, because there are great organizations that have wonderful people at every level. And everyone who's doing this type of work like deserves that. And I can't remember the original question, but I do really, really, it's a big issue for me to make sure that really good people are taken care of.
Yeah, I also recall you saying something about like making sure that you're like getting that grant that like justifies like your worth. I will mention Fawnalytics has a study that looks at compensation in the farmed animal advocacy sector. So we surveyed a bunch of organizations, the number 27 organizations, I think, and we're able to pull like salaries across all participating organizations. So this is publicly available data. So if you want to be able to like request a raise to make sure you're being fairly compensated, we have this information for you. And not you specifically, anybody who's listening is what I'm trying to allude to.
No, I think that's great. Cause also like if people are being compensated and they have like the appropriate benefits to have a work-life balance, then they stay. If people stay, they have all the institutional knowledge. If they have the institutional knowledge, they'll be able to do the work faster and better than bringing on someone new. Not saying that there aren't any job seekers that really would do great, because I know a few of them, but yeah, take care of the people. And I feel very lucky because I don't feel like I'm in a position where I have to prove my worth. And I think that is indicative of the organization that I'm at, because it really is like a human first mentality. And also like, and this hasn't always been the case in places that I have worked, we have like such sustainable growth strategy and such like financial responsibility that if we had a really bad fundraising year this year, no one's going to lose their jobs. And having that safety net because of leadership and our board, that means that I can sleep at night if there's like an emergency going on in my own life. Not to say that I want any more fires in Los Angeles. Come on, people.
Those are incredibly great points to note and memorize. I would add, you know, yes, it is important to get great compensation, but be careful. You know, there are jobs with, you know, great salary offers, but the culture is not that good. And you really need to prioritize the culture versus the salary. You won't win with, you know, just the salary. You only have one body and one mind.
Yeah.
You can always make more money later or from, you know, another better offer elsewhere. But yeah, so be careful about the...
Yeah. Also, I'm such a better fundraiser getting to like fundraise for an organization that I believe in, where I truly am proud of all of my coworkers and what they do. I am so impressed by each and every one of them. And like, I can't do their jobs. They can't do my job. I can't do their job. Truly. More so, they don't want to do my job. they could probably do it. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, if you are working for a mission that you believe in and in an organization that does have healthy culture, fundraising is so much easier.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask something else. This time related to impact. And I've been playing with this idea that often the focus in our movement is to convert people to a vegan lifestyle or a healthy, fiber-rich lifestyle, whatever terms we use. But there are people who just won't do it for a number of reasons, many of them being valid reasons. You know, if you're struggling with an eating disorder, I don't think, you know, you should be the target of people wanting you to become vegan in any case. So what about alternatives to advance the movement? And of course, for me, the answer to that is donations. If you cannot become vegan, you can still become a donor for the cause, and you're going to still, you know, make a huge impact with your gift. What do you make of that idea?
I think that's a really interesting idea. I feel like I've used it as an argument in a very different subject matter, where I've suggested to non-vegan business owners that they have a vegan business. I'm like, okay, if you don't want to, but if your business is vegan, you're still doing wonderful, like, good in this world. And I love the utopian vision of everyone being vegan. That'd be amazing. My husband's not vegan. We are going to have vegan babies one day, but he's not vegan, and maybe he'll never go vegan. And, you know, honestly, sometimes he walks in a room and he's better equipped to get someone to try a vegan product because he's not vegan and they don't want to listen to the vegan.
Yeah, this world is complex beyond our, grasp. And yeah, I definitely understand the struggle of living with people who are not vegan. Liz?
Yeah, gosh. All this makes me think of is I like in my head is stuck as when I went to the Animal and Vegan Advocacy Summit. Gosh, this was like 3 years ago now. I think it was like the first year or something. Steven from Connect for Animals did a lightning presentation on social contagion theory, and that has just really stuck with me. It's like the idea that, sometimes we're in this silo, this like tunnel vision of veganism, right? Because everybody around us is vegan, like our coworkers are, or the people in our movement are. But there's an entire world where people really like do not vibe with us. And I have just kept this in my mind as I moved out to the rural countryside, and it's like nobody here is. There's like no restaurants with vegan options. And so am I going to turn any of those people away from donating to my sanctuary? Absolutely not. That would be ludicrous because we know that vegans aren't the majority of the population. We're already dealing with such a small pot of money. Do we really want to restrict ourselves more? And I wouldn't even say it's about like morals, like only accepting money from vegans, because that's not going to advance our mission. And so, like, as long as you have a proper, I would say, like gift acceptance policy, I would definitely not including donations from non-vegans or like vegetarians or flexitarians or reducetarians or omnivores. Like, there's just so much good we can do, and everybody is at a different step in their journey. If people didn't take my money before I went vegan, like that would be really awful because that would really not be good for them. So I think we just have to meet people where they are and kind of reach out to them with baby steps. It's been proven to work. It's like different strokes for different folks, right?
Totally. And I think, our donor base and our supporters and even our participants are not necessarily vegan or plant-based, but they want healthier options, and those just once more so happen to be plants. And so by like for us, we focus on the nutrient interventions as it's something that people don't argue against. If we're showing them the evidence-based science and we're saying like, we need to focus on low cholesterol and lower saturated fats and lower sodium and this, that, and the other thing. And this is how you do it. And we provide the solutions for that. And children are consuming more plants. It's a win-win for everyone. I mean, even a lot of our work on the policy front in the last few years has been working in response to upon request legislature. That's like legislation that passed in Illinois, where there was a law that passed that said if a student requests a plant-based school lunch, that the school is required to provide it. And so we co-founded the Plant-Based School Lunch Collaborative and More Plants on Plates Illinois, where we worked with a philanthropy organization and a marketing firm to get the word out and to make the resources easily accessible, and so that students could request plant-based school lunches through the programs and the infrastructure that was already in place. Were all those people vegan? Probably not. And so we need to work together. I mean, my non-vegan friends go to vegan restaurants all the time. They buy Miyoko's butter, they get the plant-based meat alternatives, they drink oat milk and soy milk, baby steps.
Why do you think people don't consider fundraising as a valid form or more popular form of activism? Like, people go and protest and go on, do all sorts of things in the name of animals, but fundraising is always at the bottom of the list, if not, not even on the list. So why aren't people thinking about fundraising as a valid way to do activism?
People are afraid to ask for help in general. Like, I just feel like that's applicable across like just humanity. It's like the idea of being vulnerable and saying like I need you for something. But like I mentioned before, I don't really see it as asking. I see it as like a collaboration, a connection, a relationship. And so we don't really take that approach, but I can definitely see like people just not feeling comfortable asking. We've seen that like peer-to-peer giving is a really big struggle for our organization, is a trying to convince people to fundraise on behalf of our organization. And I think it's just because people are uncomfortable having to make that ask. There's so much going on in the world that it can feel really privileged to say, like, will you donate to animals? And so, I mean, I don't think everybody has to is the thing, right? I wish everybody did. But I think people should really focus on what they're most passionate about. And then that will show through your activism. So if you are like a very much on the grounds person and you want to protest your heart's content, do that. Do it effectively. Read our research on what the most effective ways are. But as long as you're putting your all into to everything and trying to make sure that you're, doing it with the most effective strategies, tactics, I don't think that everybody should have to fundraise if they don't want to.
I really like
Like,
that.
would.
I really like that approach, Liz. I think also it's like giving within your means. And I think the last number of years have just been collectively really hard. We survived a global pandemic. There's numerous political issues across numerous countries going on. There is just like so much happening that, and the news cycle just goes so fast now. So I think there's probably like a collective compassion fatigue as well. And so people are just tuning out. There's so much. Our inboxes are flooded every single day. And so a lot of people are just at capacity. And that has like changed our approach even to Giving Tuesday, where we limit the amount of emails. Not we're not we are participating, we are sending out emails, but we're not going to be sending out 8 or 10 emails. People are getting emails from everyone. I think we just really like focus on the human first component more than anything else, and we are all on the receiving end of that. And yeah, I agree. We all have our own like special gifts and talents and interests and flavors. And if that is protesting, if that is working in the movement, you are fundraising. You are giving. You are donating by giving your time, volunteering, direct rescue. There's so many different things that are so valid. And if you can give on top of that, if you have the capacity, fantastic. Should you donate and go hungry? No.
Last question. Sanctuaries. It feels like sanctuaries are just struggling for money. As someone, struggling for air and drowning, like this is the image I get every time I come across, different sanctuaries. What do you make of that? Why are sanctuaries the ugly duck of the movement and not getting much love from funders? What's happening here?
Oh boy. So I don't know if you knew this about me, but I have a sanctuary. I have a micro san a chicken micro sanctuary. And so I have this really unique experience of working for both what I would say is like an international organization. We conduct research that reaches and is translated into many languages across the world. And then I have a very micro chicken sanctuary with 22 rescued chickens. So I see like two completely opposite, not opposites, but they mesh well, sides of the movement. I think, in my opinion, sanctuary's hardest thing to overcome is legitimacy in the movement. I think there isn't really a good network right now of sanctuaries, and it's something that I've been working very hard on trying to help fix. You'll see things like sanctuary meetups at the Animal and Vegan Advocacy Summit. You'll see things like the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries, GFAS, which does accreditation, but isn't always realistic for all sanctuaries. And there isn't really a collective or a network where all the sanctuaries gather together to share resources or data or research. Like I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, Faunalytics did do a study with Farm Sanctuary, but that was in 2021. So again, it's getting older now. Personally, I do think that sanctuaries are very effective, not just because I have one, but because I've taken time to like look through the research and data that shows that like positive solution-focused messaging is more effective than graphic imageries. Like sanctuaries can kind of bypass this like moral disengagement because they're not triggering guilt. They're like creating a connection. They're like fostering empathy. And I think like sanctuaries do a really good job at shifting social norms. I think the biggest issue is that sanctuaries don't see that they're doing this. They're so focused on the individual animals that they're rescuing that they have a hard time because of capacity, because they're so overburdened. A lot of them are just volunteer run, like ours is. Myself and my partner, we don't take a dime from it. All of our team is volunteer. It's all stuff that we just do. But yeah, I think that they have a really, really hard time being able to like take a step back from that animal care, having the capacity to do so and say like, okay, well, how are we influencing people online? How are we influencing people who come for tours? And so my hope is that over the next few years that there'll be more collaboration, and this will be something that we'll look at more.
That is like so tender and from the heart. I mean, I it's so interesting because I feel like this has been a shift even just in the time that I've been, part of the movement where, and I feel like since people have been able to accumulate some of this data, they've kind of shifted away from funding sanctuaries in many ways. And I totally understand wanting to have, spare as many animals as possible. I think that is a very valid approach. And at the same time, like each animal at a sanctuary has the ability to be an ambassador for their species and honestly deserves to have a life that feels and, feels good and make sure that they're well taken care of and well fed and nurtured and loved. And, there's so much goodness that can come from that too. It really is a both and so that's why I think focusing on there's the donor that's going to be motivated by the sanctuary experience and story and what it means in this space. And then there's going to be the folks that, have a totally different psychology and giving approach, and that is okay. But I think there's room for both. And it would be a huge disservice to not promote sanctuaries and the people who are running them because they are so hardworking. And I can only imagine how like the effects of inflation and the cost of living has changed things. Because if I'm feeling it when I'm going to the grocery store, I can only imagine when it comes to like animal feed and supplies and supply chain issues or veterinary care. Because if I can feel that with my dogs, how much it costs for them, how much is it on a grander scale? So I can see where the day-to-day is really hard and really expensive. And I feel like there's still a lot of value there. And so just finding the right people who, get to experience that. Because, I mean, it really is a gift to the animals, to the humans, everyone.
Yeah, if you're a sanctuary owner like Liz, take note of Alice and Liz's answers because you have your case of support right there. I could go on with questions. There's so much to cover with fundraising. By the way, do we all have like birds, birds, creatures, artwork on our background?
I'm trying to see like what my back, I'm trying to remember what my background. I think it's like fruit, coffee, and like butterflies and flowers.
No.
You have a little rooster somewhere. Oh wait, yeah, there's a little chicken.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and then mine's just like a whole smorgasbord of chicken art.
Yeah.
I went for the swans. So.
For the swan.
Okay, so did you want to add something before I stop the recording?
Yeah, I mean, so I would just say, like, for any fundraisers that are listening to this, yeah, join our Hive fundraising community calls. For any donors who are listening to this, consider donating to Fawnalytics and Balanced, of course. And then also just if you're an advocate who's just like curious about fundraising, Animal Advocacy Careers is absolutely amazing and has a great course where you can learn more about fundraising. You can always reach out to me. I'll provide my email so people can connect with us. And then, yeah, if anybody is just listening to this just for general, I was going to say shits and giggles, you might have to cut that out, but if they're just listening for fun, then feel free to use Fawnalytics office hours anytime you need any advocacy help.
Thank you, Liz. Alice?
I love that. I mean, let's see. Trying to think. Honestly, I think like just having these types of conversations more regularly, I think it like really one, you know, it provides an opportunity for connection and collaboration. I get a lot more energy when I'm like talking to really wonderful people about the good work that they're doing. And it is inspiring. And I'm very grateful for the in-person opportunities that we do have allotted to us, whether it's at AVA, Reducitarian. I'm really excited to go to Reducitarian in October. I'm really excited to go to Yes, exactly. I love conferences. It is weird. I lose my voice, my throat hurts, and I'm happy. And I'm so drained at the end of it, but I can't sleep. And then, I think like, we just need to have more human time talking with each other, with our fellow organizations, with funders, and continue to have these conversations. And yes, donate to Fawnalytics, donate to Balanced, vet the organizations that you give to, see who's working together behind the scenes. One thing I will add too, I think we were touching on it earlier on about like the metrics that organizations have been providing. And one thing that we did, I feel like this is not for a tail end of a conversation, but one thing that we did that I thought was like really great is during the pandemic when data was really hard to produce, or we said that we were transparent and we said, you know what, we can't tell you the numbers right now, because we have no idea how to measure them at this juncture. But once we figure that out, we'll keep you in the loop. So being honest, being transparent, maintaining relationships, and we just got to continue to cheerlead for each other. I love it.
Liz, Alice, Fawnalytics and Balanced are really lucky to have you. You are, of course, you're experts and truly true professionals. So yeah, really lucky to have you. And thank you so much for having answered my questions and shared your insights and knowledge with everyone. Thank you everyone for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.